Good morning.
Good morning.
I have the good fortune of bringing the lesson to you today. We are going to be, of course, in Psalm 19. Before we begin, Children's Church is on today, and Grace is going to be leading Children's Church, and she's in the back, so you want to head out. For those of you that want snacks, there are snacks. No, I'm just kidding. Well, today's topic is, as I said, Psalm 19, and David's psalm is written really in about four parts. He begins with this declaration about the making of the earth, of the universe, and that's what I'm going to camp on a good chunk of this, and you'll understand why as I get through it. Then he goes into the perfection of the law of the Lord, talks about that, and kind of how it can guide us. He then spends a few verses talking about the failures of man, if I can say it that way, the sin of man, especially in light of the law. And then he ends with a little prayer that his poetry, his verse, can be acceptable to God. And so, how do I say this? We don't know necessarily why God why David chose to put these particular verses this way, because he kind of goes from this universal discussion to all of a sudden the law, and there's kind of almost seems like a disconnect. But I think once you get to the end of this, you're going to see that they're actually pretty well linked. And we don't always know what David's, we know in some cases what David's motivation was. We know what he was, if he's lamenting something, he's angry, you're going to hear it in David's words in the Psalms. There's no question about it. This one's a little bit more poetic. Sometimes when you read a poem, you don't always necessarily get everything that the poet is trying to communicate. But in this case, once we get through this, I think you'll see where David was going. So let's dig in. I titled this particular lesson, God Does Not Play Dice with the Universe. By the way, this is one of the most famous pictures of Albert Einstein. It was taken by the Canadian photographer Joseph Karsh. Karsh was known for his work in black and white, and specifically portraits of many great and famous people. And this is actually a quote from Einstein. I want to be clear, and because if anybody's studied this, you might think that therefore Einstein was somehow a religious man. I'm not going to purport him to be one because I don't think he was. What Einstein meant by this particular statement was he was refuting the concept of what's called quantum mechanics. And if this is going to sound like a high school physics class, welcome back to high school, because here we go. And what he was saying was is that the quantum mechanics had kind of a little bit of a randomness to it, has randomness to it. And Einstein really had trouble getting his head around some of the concepts of quantum mechanics because he didn't necessarily believe in disorder. He believed more in order. Got to remember, you go back to Newton, Isaac Newton, the apple falling and bonking him on the head and going, gravity. Newtonian physics was the big thing. And Newton still carries a lot of weight. A lot of his laws still have merit, okay? We say laws, I use that in the broad sense. Theories is another way to say it. I also want to preface this by saying theories, when you hear the thing like the theory of the Big Bang or the Big Bang theory, that is the way that scientists work through particular things of trying to understand how the world works, how the universe works. They create a theory. It's a construct of thought to help describe something going on. And it achieves some, if it's a good theory, it achieves some form of acceptance by whatever scientific body, be it physicists, chemists, whatever, okay? Therefore, Einstein's position, he was the guy who came up with the theory of relativity, has to do with space and time and gravity and those kinds of things. That was the prevalent theory. It still is held by many people. And it has weight because he mathematically showed kind of why his theory carries weight, okay? So if I can just preface it by that. But they are theories. It's, again, a man-made construct to try to describe something going on in the physical world. whatever that is, from the atom all the way out to the stars. Okay? So, Nicholas Copernicus. I bring that up because there's a beautiful park right over here named after him. Please go see it. No, I'm just kidding. I mean, why Nicholas Copernicus? Anybody know why Nicholas Copernicus is famous? What was his? I mean, he was a mathematician and an astrologer. Go ahead, Michael.
The one who first heliocentric.
Heliocentrism, very good. Actually, Galileo was, but that's good because Galileo was the first one who postulated, that's the word postulated, he theorized that, wait, I think the Earth rotates around the sun. Galileo ran into trouble because that was counter to the Catholic Church. I'm not slamming Catholics here. The Catholic Church believed, no, Earth was the center and everything rolled around it. We'll get to why they thought that in a minute. What made Nicholas Copernicus famous was he's the guy who actually mathed it out, if I can say that that way. He actually went through and did the calculations and things and said, oh, no, the sun is at the center of our solar system. We're not. The sun is. And by the way, Galileo got excommunicated. Nicholas Copernicus he got quashed. The church kind of prevented his books and things from being published around this for a while. Kind of interesting. So, but Copernicus really was the one who mathed out that it's not what they call heliocentric or sun-centric. The solar system is sun at the center and all the planets go around it. Okay. So, our sun, this is a tinted, because you couldn't stare at it otherwise, you'd go blind. Our sun is 865,000 miles in diameter. You're going to get a lot about size and time here, so just bear with me, okay, because this is important. 865,000 miles in diameter. It is 93 million miles from here to there, okay? It takes just over 8 minutes for sunlight to reach the Earth. Some say about 8 minutes, 11 seconds. So by extension, if the sun burned out, how long would it take before we were in darkness? 8 minutes, about 8 minutes, 11 seconds, and then we'd be in darkness if the sun burned out. By the way, that little blue dot, that's Earth. To scale. Okay? So it kind of gives you a sense of scale. So when we see the sun come up, and by the way, David uses this language in the Psalms. We're going to get to the Psalm here, but just bear with me. When he uses the phrase, he's like a bridegroom coming out of his tent or his pavilion, he's like the runner getting ready to run his course, you can understand why the Earth-centered theory held so much weight for so long. Because what does it look like when we see the sun? We say it comes up in the and goes down in the right. East-west. Sorry, my hands were in the wrong way. East-west. It looks like it runs a circuit. And that's the language David uses. It runs a circuit. So it goes by us. We now know that's not true because to us it looks like it moves that way, but it moves that way or looks that way because the Earth rotates a day, 24 hours. It takes 24 hours for the Earth to rotate one turn, okay? So it looks like that, but it's fixed. We're moving. Isn't that interesting? It's fixed and we're moving. So that's how that happens. Okay. Now get ready for more mind-blowing information. In researching this, I came to find out that our sun is called a yellow dwarf. I think that's just horrible. Who could call our sun a dwarf? Something that's 865,000 miles in diameter and we're calling it a dwarf? Wow. But here I'm here to tell you, yeah, it is. These are some of the stars in our sky and their relative scales. Sirius, Pollux, Arcturus, Rigel, Aldebaran, Betelgeuse, Antares. Those are in scale. Betelgeuse, by the way, is the name of the star that's in Orion, the Hunter. Anybody know what's going on with Betelgeuse right now? Has anybody followed this at all? Are you as geeky as I am about this stuff? There's a debate. Cliff, go ahead.
Yeah, it's oscillating in brightness, and they think it may be getting ready to blow up.
Supernova, right. It's, they're saying it might blow up. And then you get somebody who comes over and says, no, that's just a weird, they call it occultation. It's a weird dimming. It's not any signature or sign of that at all. So somebody said it was almost like space dust running in front of it. That's the problem with science theories. They argue these theories all the time. What's happening? They don't know. It's a theory. I think it might be going supernova. Others say, no, it was something else running in front of it. But here's my point. That little dot that the arrow is pointing out is our sun in comparison, and didn't go all the way up to Antares. Red giants. Somebody said if our sun eventually starts to lose its, and there's some 4 billion years before the sun would ever burn out or change its state. They said that if it blows up to a red giant, it might have a diameter about to, out to Jupiter or Saturn. That's how big it'll be. We're gone. We're toast. You know, because it'll burn past us, obviously, as it loses control. Gravity holds it in right now. That kind of thing. So we think we're really this great thing, you know. And then you go, our sun is like, it's a yellow dwarf. The diameter of our solar system is 7.34 billion miles. That's from center of the sun to out to, and yes, that's Pluto, and I'm calling Pluto a planet. I should have a bumper sticker. Pluto is a planet. Everybody understand the debate about Pluto? Some say it's an ice dwarf from the Oort cloud and all that kind of thing. It's not really, it's a moonlet. You know, it's not really a planet. I consider it a planet. But anyway, 7.34 billion miles across. Huge. Huge. Now we have to talk about this concept, a light year. You'll hear a
the distance that light travels in 1 year. Now you do the math out. Light travels, the speed of light is 186,282 miles per second. Multiply that by 60 seconds in a minute, you get roughly 11.2 million miles. By 60 minutes in an hour, 24 hours in a day, 365.24 days in a year, you are now at 5.8 trillion, that's with a T, trillion miles. We balk at our national debt at, what are we at right now? 2.5 trillion? Try 5.8 trillion miles. That's light in 1 year, okay? This is at an R in the Milky Way galaxy. We're in one of the arms. I can't remember if Orion arm or Sagittarius. One of the arms. One of these swirls. The diameter of our Milky Way galaxy is 105,700 years. That's 105,700 times 5.8 trillion miles. That's where mathematicians and physicists start saying like 10 to the such and such power, because they don't want to write all the zeros all the way out here. That's how wide our galaxy is at our approximate location within it. I love this illustration because then this starts to give you senses of scale. So you see the Earth, And in the second frame, and I know it's small, but just bear with me, in the second frame it shows our relative location in the solar system. Then it goes out and shows our solar system in relative, in the third frame, relative location to our solar neighborhood. These are the other stars around us in our neighborhood. I don't know if you anybody follow the Voyager missions, the Voyager space probes. They fired off back in the 70s. It took 47 years, I think it was, for the first Voyager to leave the solar system. And it's traveling at 18,000 miles an hour. It's down in what they call interstellar space. It's between our star. Oh, I'm losing time.
Here about that.
Wow, thank you.
It's on.
Thank you.
It left the finally left the influence of the our star, and now it's in interstellar space. It's moving somewhere in that solar our solar system in the Milky Way. But wait, it gets bigger. Bottom left, this is our galaxy in the local galactic group. It's where we sit, and there are galaxies around us.
We are then in what's called the Virgo. That's the constellation Virgo. We're in the supercluster of galaxies. Superclusters are galaxy clusters. And then you can see all the superclusters around Virgo. And then finally,
where the supercluster is in relation to the observable universe.
We're very tiny.
I'm going to tell you this. There are times, we talked this morning in Bible class about worship. There are times where I'm in remote places, usually hunting, but I'm in remote places where there is no city light. Stand out there and look up at that, and you know who God is. And you know your position. So when you start to think you're all that in a bag of chips, just remember, this is a good three-dimensional representation. You can see almost right dead center is the Virgo supercluster. That's, remember I said we're in the Virgo supercluster of galaxies. But then these are all of the, in three dimensions, all of the superclusters that they've identified around us. And then there are the voids. That's the problem. There are places where there appears to be no stars. The largest is the Boötes, it's pronounced. Not booties. Boötes void is the largest. Here's what one of those voids looks like. It's just a hole. Okay. Back in the 80s, NASA decided they were going to take the Hubble Space Telescope and over a span of about 10 days, point it at one of those voids. Just, you had to point it that long because it needed that much time for the light to be gathered. Because you're pointing at a black spot. So if there's any light in there, you got to leave it stationary and point it at that spot for time so that it can gather as much light as it did. And when they processed what came back from the Hubble, that was what was in the void. We just couldn't see it with the telescopes we had, but the Hubble could. I'm going to tell you that every one of those pinpoints of light is a galaxy. So in other words, what we thought was a void wasn't. And what we found were not just stars. We found galaxies. Hundreds of millions, if not billions, of stars in these galaxies. in the void. It's huge. It's huge. This is God. I look at this and I go, this is God's playground. This is his backyard. You know? The God of the universe created this. So what is this? What are we looking at? This is a representation of the Big Bang expansion. The Big Bang is a theory, and it's based on the fact that the universe is expanding, meaning it had, when you take the math and you work backwards, they can see the pace of things moving in space. You work the math backwards, you get to some initiation point. Because they can just, it's like your home movie of watching Uncle Bob fall off his water skis. You burn it backwards and Bob's back on the skis. It's the same concept, you know what I mean? It's running it backwards math-wise. They said, well, there had to be an inception point, okay? So that's the Big Bang. Now, those of us that are Christians, what's the Big Bang inception point? Genesis, God said, let there be light. And that started things going. The thing is that according to the math, where we are today, the inception point was 13.7 billion years ago. Standard belief of the span of the Bible was how many years? About 6,000 years, right. Then I'm reminded of the verse, to God a thousand years is a, and a day is a thousand years. God's clock is different than man's clock. That's what I'm going to tell you. That's all I can say, okay? But this is the expansion of the universe as we understand it today and the time it took. And now we move to this little device. Anybody know what this is? James Webb Space Telescope. Launched 2 years ago. Sits about 1 million miles out from the Earth. This was waited for decades. They wanted this. It took them a long time. It was delayed and delayed and delayed. Finally, they got everything right. Now, the delays, you could say, oh, another government project. What do you expect? I gave them a lot of slack on this one because you're launching something 1 million miles out. There ain't no repair truck going to go out there to fix it. So if it's not working right, it's not working right. Remember, we sent guys up to fix the Hubble when it had a little bit of a blurry vision problem, you know. Can't do that with James Webb. So it took them a while to get that out there. What makes James Webb different than Hubble is Hubble was a visual telescope. It's a big mirror telescope like you'd have at any observatory. What made James Webb different is it's an infrared primarily. An infrared, it's looking in the infrared spectrum. Different device, measuring similar things, same things, but a different type of measurement. What are they doing with it besides looking for exoplanets and things like that? What are they doing with it? One of the primary jobs that they're trying to do is get back to that end of that cone. They want to get back to the end of the starting point of the universe. They want to see what was there. Here's the thing. Every observable thing in astronomy, every observing tool that they have is a time machine. Why is it a time machine? If the sun burns out, how long does it take before we would know? A little over 8 minutes before we know it was black. We are looking at light that originated back in time. I know, wrap your head around that one. But that's what we're looking for. So far, this is the only one that has been, they found another one and it now has been refuted because of, again, light variation. This was the farthest one they've seen. It is a galaxy, and it is just 400 million years after the Big Bang. Just 400 million years. You see what I'm saying? That's a long time. By the way, it's called Maisie's Galaxy because the astronomer found it on his daughter Maisie's birthday. And it's now called Maisie's Galaxy. I'm sure that'll, when Maisie passes on to her award, something about that will be mentioned, I'm sure, that it was named after her. Here's the other thing, besides, remember I said they're doing primarily looking back in the cone to see when it started? Here's the other one. They've now spotted these. They're Jupiter mass binary objects, or jumbos for short. What they have found is planets. Now, Jupiter is what we call a gas giant, but a planet. And they found two of them of that size, Jupiter size, orbiting each other. And according to physics and astrophysics, that can't happen. And when I read this and saw this, I'm like, and by the way, astronomers like Neil deGrasse Tyson and those guys, their heads just went, phew, they exploded because they said, this can't exist, this can't happen. The astronomers are amazed. And I looked at this and I'm saying, God is up there going, just wait. Wait till you see the other stuff you're going to find. That's the Milky Way, by the way, part of it. Night sky, no city light. You can take a picture and see the Milky Way, one of the arms. And God said, let there be lights in the vault of the sky to separate the day from the night. And let them serve as signs to mark sacred times and days and years. And let them be lights in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth. And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. Everything I talked to until this point, he made it. God set them in the vault of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. And there was evening, and there was morning. And this was the fourth day of creation. I am always struck by the God verses that talk about this stuff. Book of Job. Can you bind the chain of the Pleiades? By the way, the Pleiades is that little blue cluster up there to the right. The seven sisters they're known as. Can you loosen Orion's belt? You know what Orion's belt, have you seen Orion's belt in the sky? The three stars that are his belt in the center there? That's Orion, by the way. Betelgeuse is the one that's over on that left shoulder, kind of, with his raised arm, that shoulder over there. That's Betelgeuse. That's the one that they're questioning whether it's going to be around. Can you bring forth the constellations? This is God talking to Job now. Can you bring forth the constellations in their seasons? Or lead out the bear with its cubs? What is the bear? Ursa Major. We would call it the Big Dipper. That's Ursa Major, Big Bear, Ursa Major in Latin, Big Bear. By the way, there's Ursa Minor, that's the cub. Do you know the laws of the heavens? Can you set up God's dominion over the earth? and now David. The heavens declare the glory of God. The skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day after day, they pour forth speech. Night after night, they reveal knowledge. They have no speech. They use no words. No sound is heard from them. Yet their voice goes out into all the earth. I might argue, into all the universe. Their words to the ends of the world in the heavens. Excuse me, God has pitched a tent for the sun. It's like God built the place where the sun sits. It's like a bridegroom coming out of his chamber, like a champion rejoicing to run his course. Again, that's the sun moving. Rises at one end of the heavens and makes its circuit to the other more. Nothing is deprived of its warmth. By the way, when I showed you the solar system, plenty of thought around the fact that our Earth is tilted at the right angle, and it is the perfect distance from the sun. Too far out, too far in, wrong tilt, wrong rotation. Pretty cool. So, here's my point. The poet David begins Psalm 19. He sings the praises of God and the perfection in his design of the universe. And this is where, between verses 6 and 7, things shift. Because then he says, he starts building on that foundation, and he goes beyond it, and he begins to apply God's perfection to the law. In other words, his theory in his poem is God designed all of this, and it's perfect. It might confuse a lot of astronomers and physicists, but God designed it, and it's perfect. And by the way, God also wrote the law that we follow. It's perfect. And there's benefit to it, to following it. The law of the Lord is perfect, refreshing the soul. The statutes of the Lord are trustworthy, making wise the simple. The precepts of the Lord are right, giving joy to the heart. The commands of the Lord are radiant, giving light to the eyes. The fear of the Lord is pure, enduring forever. The decrees of the Lord are firm, and all of them are righteous. They are more precious than gold, than much pure gold. They are sweeter than honey from the honeycomb. By them your servant is warned. In keeping them, there is great reward. That's what the Bible is. Think about it. I stole this. This is not a new thing. Basic instructions before leaving Earth. That's what David's saying. The Bible gives us the way, the path, the right way to live. And it contains a promise. Keep it, and you'll be rewarded. I don't mean in the name it and claim it sense, but your life will go a lot better. We kind of talked about that in the Bible class this morning. Trying to chase after the things of the world, the things of this earth, they're fleeting. I will be 67 this year. Where did those years go? It goes fast. I know all the younger people will go, yeah, we know it goes fast. It goes fast. My grandson turned 11 on Friday. What? I said to my son, why do you keep feeding him? You know, just. You stand under the heavens and you realize who you are. You stand in face of the law. And now David transitions and says, but who can discern their own errors? God, forgive my hidden faults. Keep your servant also from willful sin. May the willful sins not rule over me. Then I will be blameless, innocent of great transgression. So keep me from the ones that are hidden that I don't always think about. Keep me from the bigger ones, because then I will be innocent of great transgression. And his closing, after he writes all these beautiful words, this beautiful poem, he just turns to God and says, "May the words of my mouth and this meditation of my heart be pleasing in your sight, Lord, my rock and my redeemer." Prophetic? Why would David's use of the word redeemer be prophetic? Because God put it on his heart that there will be redemption. And we know where that redemption will come from, right? Many of David's psalms point prophetically to Christ. I don't think this one is any different. He looks upon God as his rock, his steady foundation, and he looks upon him as the Redeemer that will redeem him from sin. Let's pray. Father, we look at the things of the world you created, the universe you created, and we boggle sometimes at the distances and times and sizes of things within the universe you created. But how wonderful your mind, how wonderful your power, how amazing. We just acknowledge that you are the creator of all things. No matter how man tries to understand it all, you're in control. You know what you have put in place. You know the times. You know the seasons. And so when we think and start to worry, help us to remember that you are the God of the universe and you are in control. Thank you for your law. Thank you for your word that guides us and helps us to understand who you are and how we're to live. Help us to always keep it in our minds and on our hearts and on our lips. Help us to live it day to day. Help us to give ourselves in worship and obedience to you. And thank you for your plan that David can even write about a redeemer. For we know that we need Jesus because of our sin and because of the fact that you love us so much that he had to come and rescue us from our sad state. We give him all the glory and honor that is due him as the King. We ask all these things in Christ's name. Amen.